Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
So let's do something together. Let's hold our hands about that far apart, and we're going to bring them together really, really slowly. Please feel whether it's your fingertips that are leading your hands, or is it the palms of your hands that are bringing your hands together? As your hands get closer, do they feel each other? Is there some energy exchanged between them? When they touch, do all the fingers touch at the same time? Is there some sequence? What does it feel like to have your fingers touching each other? I'm going to do it again. Only this time I'm going to do it without my words. And I'm going to ask you to do one more thing. I'm going to ask you to breathe. Well, you're breathing anyway, but pay attention to your breathing. See if you can't harmonize, synchronize the movement of your hands with your breath. If you'd like, you can think of your breath as drawing your hands together. So let's try that. Was it easier or harder with your breath? How many people thought it was easier? Yeah, I cheated the first time. I can't do it without following, paying attention to my breath. Our breath really does have a way of bringing us back to awareness. And so if you're trying to pay attention to something, really detailed attention like moving your hands, your breath helps a lot. Okay, so Koshin asked me to give a talk today about Buddha nature, and I said I can't do that. And I foolishly said I would give a talk instead about Buddha mind, but I can't do that either. Okay. For me to give a talk about Buddha mind would be like for me to hold up a drawing by my 4-year-old granddaughter and say, look, it's a picture of Mount Rainier, because there'd be V-shape here, and there'd be some pink stuff here, that's sunset on Mount Rainier. And she doesn't need the color within the lines, so it really... But supposing that I had a really good painting by one of the best painters on the island, or supposing I had a photograph and I held it up and said, this is Mount Rainier. You'd say, no, that's a picture of Mount Rainier. That isn't Mount Rainier. And that's why I can't give a talk about Buddha mind, because anything I say is just going to be a picture, a verbal picture. And that's why I did this for you, or you did this with me. Because if you weren't thinking, if your mind wasn't full of thoughts, if you were just experiencing the movement of your hands, that is your Buddha mind. So right away you're all skeptical and say, come on. But think about it. Supposing the Buddha had been asked to pull his hands together, would his mind have been any different from your mind? There's a saying in Zen, when in the middle of the night you reach out for your pillow, is your hand any different from the hand of the Buddha? It's a fundamental tenet of Zen that from the very beginning of time, or no time, we all are intrinsically Buddhas. And this must mean that we are endowed with the same mind as the Buddha had. The problem is that, of course, usually it's filled with thoughts, but maybe for a moment, just for a moment, your mind was empty as you moved your hands. And for that moment, your mind was indistinguishable from the mind of the Buddha. Now I've ruined it for you, because the next time you do this, you're going to be thinking, Buddha mind! And that is a problem, right? That is a problem, is that we tend to think about the words rather than experience the experience. And one of my favorite examples is that it has become very fashionable these days for people to say, I live in the present moment. And the minute you say that, you're telling a lie. Because the present moment just passed while you were saying that. You're living in your memory of the past moment. You want to live in the present moment, experience your breath. Feel the cushion under your buttocks. Listen to the sounds. That's what the present moment is. The minute you think about it, though, it's like Buddha mind. It's gone. You're back into your thoughts. There's another name for the aspect of Buddha mind which is free of thought, and that's called mirror mind. It's another name. But Buddha mind is a really kind of sticky name, right? Buddha, you know, it's... I'm Buddha, wow. But mirror mind, we know about mirrors. That's much more concrete. Right? And what do mirrors do? Well, mirrors reflect. That is, they reflect when they're not dusty. You have a dusty mirror. If you go up to the attic and you have a mirror up in the attic and it's all covered with dust, it does not reflect very well. And those of you who know something about the history of Buddhism, thanks to Koshin's class, know that mirror mind played a role in the succession of the sixth patriarch of Zen following the fifth patriarch. So the fifth patriarch was getting old, and he needed to find a successor. And so he created a poetry contest. He said, okay, so anyone who wants to bring forth a poem that expresses your understanding of Zen. And all the monks said, well, we're not nearly as good, not really as accomplished as the head monk. Let's get him to do it. And the head monk didn't want to do it either. The head monk actually wrote an anonymous poem on the wall of the monastery. And let me quote it. The head monk's name is Shen Shu, and he wrote, "The mind is like a clear mirror. Moment by moment, wipe it carefully, let no dust alight on it." But he lost the poetry contest. Because the sixth patriarch, who was hardly the head monk, he was working in the granary, polishing rice. He heard about this poem, and he couldn't read, so he had someone read it to him. And then he composed his own poem, and his poem was, "From the beginning, there is no mirror bright. So there's nowhere that dust can alight." And that probably is the absolute truth. But if you want to practice Zen, if you want to practice Zen every day, You want to know how to practice. Which is more useful to you, knowing that there is no mirror and there is no dust, or knowing that your mind can be like a mirror, you just need to wipe the dust of thoughts off it. There's an expression in Zen that says, to sell gold, you must mix it with sand. So, meaning the six patriarchs verse may be pure gold. But Shen Xu's verse has enough sand in it to make the verse actually useful. It tells us how to practice. So that, for instance, when we were taking Koshin's course, he was talking about Lin Chi, who says, just be an everyday person. That's pure gold. Mix a little sand in it, though. Be a pure, just be a ordinary person with not a thought in your head, so that you are one with everything you do. So, another name for Buddha mind or mirror mind is one mind. It is a mind of oneness. So, about 2,500 years ago, on the 8th of December, it is said that the Buddha, who had been sitting for a whole week after practicing austerities, really horrible austerities for 7 years, looked up and saw the morning star. And it said that at that moment, his mind and the moment and the morning star fused. He became the morning star. There was nothing outside that star. There was nothing outside the universe. Everything was the Buddha. So I'm a scientist, so of course, you know, I don't believe that stuff. I mean, you know, the universe is out here and my mind is in here. But for those of us who've gone out on a really clear, moonless night and looked up at the stars and just for a moment experienced without a single thought this myriad of stars around us, and we lose all sense of ourself as something separate, and for that instant, for that fraction of an instant, we've had a tongue-tip taste of what the Buddha experienced. And that's possible because we have exactly the same mind that the Buddha had. The only difference is that usually our minds are filled with thoughts, but at that moment when we look at the stars and they're just overwhelmed, become one with the stars, then our minds are exactly like the Buddha's mind. Of course, if you try and talk to somebody or explain that experience, it's lost. The Buddha couldn't say a word about the experience. The Buddha never said what he experienced. It's impossible. You can kind of indicate it, you can paint a picture of it, but it is not the experience itself. And the Buddha was very smart, very great teacher. He knew that if he painted pictures, people would look at the picture and think that the picture was the real thing. They would look at my 4-year-old granddaughter's picture of Mount Rainier at sunset, and they'd say, oh, there's Mount Rainier at sunset. But that is not Mount Rainier at sunset, and any description of the Buddha's experience is not the Buddha's experience itself. But it's an experience that we all can have. If we haven't, though, we won't be able to talk about it. There's a wonderful story about a non-Buddhist who comes to the Buddha and says, I do not ask for words, I do not ask for silence, please teach me. That's what the Buddha does. The non-Buddhist says, the world-honored one with his great compassion has opened the clouds of my delusion and allowed me to enter the way. So, of course, the question for all of us is, what did the non-Buddhist say? What did the Buddha do? He just, I hate to defile it with words, but he just sat there. He didn't use words. Did he use silence? Did he use anything that we can describe in words? No, he just sat there. And the non-Buddhist saw this and came to some sort of awakening. We're not the only ones who wondered what the non-Buddhist saw. Ananda, who was the Buddha's closest disciple, was present. And as soon as the non-Buddhist leaves, Ananda turns to the Buddha and said, "What did the non-Buddhist realize to make him praise you like that?" So maybe we should say a little bit more about Ananda. Ananda was really the Buddha's closest disciple. He was his cousin. And he was the disciple of greatest memory and hearing. So for about 300 years, none of the Buddha's sermons were written down. They were passed on orally. And they were passed on orally because apparently Ananda heard each one of them and remembered them perfectly, we are told, and passed them on. And in fact, every Buddha sutra begins with, "Thus have I heard." Not, "This is what I've written, this is what I've read." It's, "This is what I've heard." Those are Ananda's words. "This is what I've heard from the Buddha." So how does Ananda's question get answered by the Buddha? Does he explain, perhaps, that the non-Buddhist saw the Buddha's mind and realized that the mind of the Buddha was the same as his mind? No, he doesn't do that. Instead, he says, "Ananda, a good horse runs fast, even at the shadow of a whip." Ananda hadn't come to realization. And it sounds as though the Buddha is maybe putting Ananda down. He's saying, you know, here's this non-Buddhist. That's why I think the story is about a non-Buddhist. Ananda's, you know, a real Buddhist, right? He's the Buddha's cousin. He's the disciple of greatest memory and hearing. And the Buddha says, "This guy's a fast horse." What is it saying about Ananda? Is that a nice thing to say to Ananda? I mean, if I had been Ananda, I would have thought, "Oh, God, I guess he thinks I'm a really slow horse, and maybe I am." So how does that make one react? Well, let me tell you a story about the difference between kindness and compassion. One of my best friends, with whom I practiced Zen for, you know, 40-some-odd years now, was graduating from law school, and he told our teacher, Roshi Kaplow, that he was about to graduate from law school, and the Roshi said, "Oh, what are you going to do?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to move to San Francisco to be with my girlfriend." And the Roshi said, "Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. When you get serious about Zen, then maybe you'll come to live at the Zen Center, or at least come to Sesshin a little more frequently." Just let it go like that. So what did my friend do? Well, the Roshi had punched his "you better show me how serious you are about Zen" button. And it worked, because at the very next session, my friend broke through his first koan, came to realization. And it was precisely because the Roshi had jabbed him in the ribs. And maybe that's what the Buddha was doing to Ananda. He was giving him a little poke. The Ananda never did come to realization under the Buddha. The Buddha died before Ananda came to realization, realized his own mind. Zen master Mumon writes about this in the Mumon Khan, a collection of koans. He says, "This is the family shame." Well, you know, he's poking fun at the Buddha. You know, here's the Buddha, and he's got his closest disciple, and his closest disciple can't come to realization under the Buddha. But Ananda eventually did come to realization. So the Buddha passed on his robe and bowl to Mahakashapa, and as you might imagine, Ananda wondered what Mahakashapa had realized that he hadn't. So one day he goes to Mahakashapa and says, "Beside the Buddha's robe and bowl, what else did you get from the Buddha?" Mahakashapa did not explain what he got from the Buddha. Instead, he said, "Ananda, yes!" Uman comments that the calling was good, but that, yes, that answer, that was even better. Why was it even better? Where did it come from? That's what Ananda must have wondered. Where did that come from? When you're driving your car and you suddenly see a deer cross the road, where does that come from? When you see a baby and you smile, where does that come from? When you chant, "Shujo Muhen Segando," where does that come from? Who is chanting? Who answered the Buddha? Who answered Mahakashapa with that yes? And this is really another aspect of Buddha mind, this responsiveness. In fact, if you were to be working with a Roshi, a teacher, and you went to him and said, "What about this mirror mind?" He might say, "Show me your mirror mind right now." What would you do? Say, "Well, you know, I mean, it's, my mind is with, you know, with, and it's empty, and yeah, right." Ding-a-ling-a-ling, end of interview. But you all know the answer to this question. How would you show your mirror mind? Don't think about it. How would you do it? There are just lots of ways. 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 So, I used to be a professor, and as a former professor, I love to talk, and I've said way, way too much today. But let me quickly say that there are three things, or three aspects of Buddha mind that I've tried to touch on. One is the fact that Buddha mind is a mirror mind. It's empty. When your mind is empty, really, honest, believe me, your mind is no different from the mind of the Buddha. The other aspect that I stressed was this aspect of oneness. This empty mind is able to embrace everything. When the Jikijitsu does prostrations, it embraces the universe. That's what symbolically it is. And then the third thing, it's responsive. If your mind isn't filled with thoughts, you can respond instantaneously to whatever happens, whatever the situation is. So, having said that, I think you should forget it all. You don't want to carry that stuff around with you. If you take anything away with you from this lecture, it's the experience that it's much easier to pay attention if you use your breath. If you want to try to keep your mirror mind free of dust, your breath is a wonderful way of doing that. And as a professor, I'm used to giving classes assignments at the end of class. I'm going to give you all an assignment. And the assignment is once today, just once, stop whatever you're doing and take three deep breaths. And if you do that, your coming to hear this talk today will not have been a total waste. Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.